Part 2. Chapter 42. On board the U.S. Navy guided missile frigate, Scott Thompson and his team from the Free Enterprise had yet to crack, although they had been grilled by the Navy commander of the ship since the time of their surrender. They had yet to disclose a thing. In the pilot house, Commander Timothy Gant was awaiting the arrival of a helicopter from shore. The sky was black and the wind was whipping the seas into a white froth. On the radar scope, a blip indicating the incoming helicopter moved nearer.
"She's on final, sir," the helmsman said. "Winds 20 to 30 from the north and northwest."
Gant reached for his radio.
"Get her secured to the deck the minute she touches down," he said to the head of his deck operations.
"Roger that, sir," the man answered.
The helicopter appeared out of the haze with her landing light illuminated. She came straight for the ship and barely slowed as she neared.
"I'm coming in hot,"
the pilot said over the radio. 100 yards, 80, 60, 40, 20, before the pilot slowed. Once he was just above the deck, one-third of the way down the ship, he saw the men with flashlights. Then he saw the open spot on the deck and dropped the helicopter down. As soon as the skids touched, a quartet of deck hands bent over at the waist ran out and secured the skids with chains. The rotor blade had not yet stopped when a single man, carrying a valise, climbed out and was led over to the door inside. Gant had come down to meet him and opened the door.
"Come on inside out of the weather," Gant said as the man entered the ship. "I'm Commander Timothy Gant."
The man was tall and lanky, with a slightly pockmarked face and a hook nose.
"Dr. Jack Berg," the man said, "Central Intelligence Agency." "The prisoners have yet to disclose anything," Gant said, leading the doctor down the passageway toward the brig.
"Don't worry," Berg said quietly. "That's what I'm here for." Finding a technician to fix the saw during the holiday had not been an easy task. Finally, Dwyer had just gone into the isolation room wearing a contamination suit and done it himself. Luckily, the problem had turned out to be simple. A belt that drove the saw blade had slipped, and Dwyer had merely needed to tighten the pulley with a wrench. After testing his repairs inside the room and finding that the saw worked fine, Dwyer exited through the isolation lock, washed his contamination suit under the chemical bath, then removed the suit, hung it on a hook, and exited back into the control area. The technician, who was monitoring the gauges, looked up as he entered.
"No leaks," he said, "and it looks like you got the saw fixed."
Dwyer nodded, then pushed the button to start the saw again. As soon as the blade was spinning, he walked over to the joystick control and lowered it down to the sample taken from the Arizona crater. The blade bit into the lemon-sized metal chunk, and sparks began to fly in the air like the flickering tendrils from a 4th of July sparkler. Dwyer was halfway through the chunk when the alarm sounded.
"Negative pressure!"
the technician shouted.
"And air!"
Dwyer shouted. The technician turned a dial and stared at the gauges on the wall.
"We're still sinking!"
he yelled. Inside the isolation room, vortices like that from a small tornado began forming. Several of the samples began to lift in the air and swirl about as if weightless, while the wrench Dwyer had left inside was sucked off the bench and danced in the air near the saw. It was like a giant drain had been opened, and the air in the room was being sucked into nothingness.
"Full air!"
Dwyer shouted. The technician spun the air control valve to full on. Still, the negative pressure grew. The inner layer of thick glass windows began to spiderweb. If they went, there was only one more layer of glass between Dwyer and the technician and certain death. The Kevlar gloves that poked through the wall were completely sucked in on themselves. Dwyer quickly slammed round metal plates over the arm openings, then flipped down the hatches that held them in place. The workbench in the room was bolted to the floor with one-inch diameter bolts. One of them sprung loose and shot toward the center of the bench. The workbench started to rock as the other bolts began to work loose.
"Sir!" the technician shouted.
We're going to lose it! I'm at full positive pressure and the vacuum's growing!
Dwyer stared into the room. He was seconds away from a maelstrom. Then it hit him, like a fist. Taking a step over to the board, he flipped on the laser. The laser lit up, and the firing end began to wildly spin. Smoke filled the room as it gyrated around, then touched down on the sample. Wherever the laser touched, it burned.
"The pressure is dropping!" the technician yelled a second later. "Back off the incoming air!"
Dwyer ordered. The objects in the room began to settle as the pressure was restored. A few minutes later, things were back to normal. Dwyer shut down the laser and stared into the room.
"Sir," the technician said a moment later, "would you mind telling me what just happened?"
"I think," Dwyer said, "there is something in those samples that likes the taste of our atmosphere."
"Good God," the technician said quietly.
"Luckily for us," Dwyer said, "we just found both the disease and the cure."
"There is more of that out there?" the technician said warily.
100 pounds.
Soon the pilgrims would begin pouring into Saudi Arabia on chartered planes, buses from Jordan, and ships crossing the Red Sea from Africa. Saud al-Sheikh still had 1,000 details to attend to, foremost of which was arranging delivery of the prayer rugs. He had been promised that the new owner of the mill would call him tomorrow. So he called the Saudi National Airline and arranged for transportation space on a 747 cargo plane in 2 days' time. If the prayer rugs did not get here on time, not even his family connections could spare him from the wrath he would face. He stared around the warehouse in Mecca. Pallets of food and bottled water stretched to the ceiling. A forklift truck drove in and lifted the first container of tents from the floor to load into the truck for delivery to the stadium. Tomorrow, the first of the tents would be erected. From then on, things would move very fast. Making a note to make sure the poles, stakes, and guidelines were taken, al-Sheikh walked toward the door to make sure the driver loaded the truck properly. Jeff Port gathered up the items he was taking from Hickman's office and stared at the head of security.
"Our warrant gives us the right to any and all items we determine might be of value."
The large manila folder in Port's hand contained documents, the dog tags, and a few stray hairs he'd found on the desk.
"I understand, Jeff," the head of security said.
"Two of my men will remain here," Port said, "in case we need anything else."
The security chief nodded. Port headed for the door and walked down the hall toward the living room, where his two detectives were waiting.
"No one in or out," Port said, "unless I okay it."
Walking from the penthouse, Port rode down in the elevator, exited the lobby, and climbed into his car. As soon as he returned to the Las Vegas Police Department, he copied the dog tags and the other documents, then faxed them to the CIA. As soon as Overholt received them, he forwarded them on to the Oregon. Hanley was reading the stack of papers when Halpert entered the control room.
"Mr. Hanley," he said, "I have my report."
Hanley nodded and handed him the papers Overholt had sent. Halpert read them, then handed them back.
"This confirms my findings," Halpert said. "I found Hunt's birth certificate. His mother, Michelle, did not list the father, but I managed to access the old hospital records and learned that the bill had been paid by one of Hickman's companies. There's no doubt now that Hunt was Hickman's son."
"So what does that have to do with the meteorite?" Hanley asked.
"Look at this," Halpert said, handing Hanley a file. "Hunt was killed by the Taliban in Afghanistan," Hanley said after he had finished reading.
"Right after that, Hickman started exhibiting strange behavior," Halpert said, reading from his notes.
"So he blames the Arab world for the death of his only son," Hanley said.
"So how did he come to fund the expedition to Greenland?" Stone asked.
"Apparently,
Since the death of his son, Hickman has funded numerous archaeological departments across the country. Ackerman's expedition for UNLV was one of several slated for the year. The primary one was an expedition to Saudi Arabia by a scholar who's trying to discredit the legend of Muhammad as a myth. Ackerman's was outside that realm, but he received funds anyway. I think that the recovery of the meteorite was just a stroke of luck.
So Hickman decided at first to use history to attack the Arab world, Hanley said slowly. Then, as if from the gods themselves, the meteorite drops in his lap.
But that has nothing to do with Islam or Muhammad, Stone noted.
Halpert nodded.
At that point, I think Hickman decided more direct retribution was needed. I found records he pulled up on his computer dated right after Ackerman's finding. They explain the radioactive nature of iridium and the dangers it poses.
So he decides to grab the meteorite, and then what, Hanley said slowly, combine it with an existing warhead and bomb some Arab country?
That's what has taken me so long, Halpert admitted. At first I was following that same train of thought that the meteorite was to be used somehow in a nuclear fashion. That was a dead end. There is simply nothing to tie him to the Ukrainian nuclear device or any other. So I started to branch out in my thinking.
Radioactive dust? Hanley asked.
That's the only other logical use, Halpert said.
What else have you found?
I found records that Hickman just purchased a textile mill in England, near the town of Maidenhead.
That's right about the current location of the meteorite, according to the tracking data, Stone said. He's planning to sprinkle it onto clothes and send them to the Middle East? Hanley asked.
I don't think so, sir, Halpert said slowly. The mill has a large order from Saudi Arabia for a shipment of woven prayer mats that has yet to be delivered.
So he's planning to sprinkle the dust on the prayer rugs and infect the Muslims while they pray, Hanley said. Diabolically evil!
He arrived in London on his jet early this morning, Halpert said. I think...
Right then, Hanley's telephone rang, and he motioned to Halpert to wait while he answered it. It was Overholt, and he got right to the point.
"We have a problem,"
Overholt began.
"No,"
the head of security for Dreamworld said.
"I'm calling from my home phone. I don't think it's tapped."
Continuing, he explained about the warrant and the items the detectives had removed. Hickman listened.
"Where are you now, sir?"
the head of security asked.
"They would really like to speak to you."
"It's better that you don't know," Hickman said.
"Is there anything you want us to do?"
"Right now," Hickman said, "there's nothing anyone can do but me."
Disconnecting, Hickman sat back in the chair in the office at Maidenhead Mills. Someone in the government was hard on his trail. It would not be long until they traced him to his current location. Reaching for the telephone, he dialed. The crewmen from the Free Enterprise that had remained in Calais when the vessel sailed north had arrived in London this morning. There were four men, a skeleton crew, really, but they were all Hickman had left. He telephoned them with their orders.
"You will need to steal a trio of trucks," Hickman said. "Nothing will be available to rent because of the holiday."
"What type?"
their leader asked.
"The cargo are standard 40-foot shipping containers that slide aboard flatbed trailers," Hickman said. "I called my man at Global Air Cargo, and he recommended a few different types of trucks."
Hickman read off the list to the man.
"Once we have them, where do we go?"
"Look at your map," Hickman ordered. "There is a town named Maidenhead, just north of Windsor."
"I see it,"
the man said. "Once you're in Maidenhead, drive to this address," Hickman said, reading off the mill's address and general directions.
"How soon do you need us?"
the man asked.
ASAP, Hickman said. I have a global Air Cargo 747 jet waiting at Heathrow for the cargo.
How'd you arrange that on New Year's Eve?
The man blurted. I own the company.
Give us at least an hour,
the man said. The faster the better.
The noose was closing, but Hickman had yet to feel it tightening around his neck. Judy Michaels taxied the amphibian alongside the Oregon, then turned off the engine and walked back to the cargo door. Waiting for the plane to float forward on the tide, she waited until she saw someone on the deck, then tossed up a rope. The deckhand secured the plane to the side, and Cliff Hornsby climbed down the ladder.
"Evening, Judy,"
he said as he began to take supplies that were being passed down to him.
"How's the weather up high?"
"Snow and sleet,"
Michael said as she, too, grabbed several of the bags and crates. Rick Barrett climbed over the side, clutching a bag. Once on the deck, he turned to Michaels.
"There's some dinner and coffee in there," he said. "I made it myself."
"Thanks," Michaels said, taking the last package. Halpert and Rise crossed over.
"Any of you men have any piloting experience?" Michaels asked before going forward to the cockpit.
"I'm taking classes," Barrett said.
"Chef and a pilot," Michaels said. "Hell of a combination. Come forward, then. You can help with radios and navigation."
"What do you need us to do?"
Halpert asked.
"Once the deckhand throws off the rope, use that boat hook to push us away. Then close and latch the door and take seats. I'll fire her up when you tell me we're clear."
Sliding into the pilot's seat, she waited until Barrett was seated next to her, then turned back to the cargo area.
"Ready when you are," she said.
Hornsby grabbed the rope that was tossed, Halpert pushed them away, and Rise fastened the door closed.
"Fire her up," Halpert said a moment later.
Michaels turned the key and the engines roared to life. Idling away from the Oregon, she waited until they were 50 yards away and advanced the throttles. The seaplane raced along the water, then lifted into the air. Michaels gained altitude, then made a sweeping left-hand turn. She was still climbing when they reached the outskirts of London. Hanley watched the amphibian taxi away on the remote cameras, then turned to Stone.
"How are you coming?" he asked.
Halpert had left his notes in the control room. Stone was following up on leads.
"I'm running through Hickman's companies now," Stone said.
"I'll check to see if Hickman's pilot has filed any other flight plans," Hanley said. At the Heathrow Airport Air Cargo Annex, a pair of pilots were sipping tea and watching the television in the lounge at the spacious Global Air Cargo Hangar.
"Have you pulled the latest weather?" the pilot asked the co-pilot.
15 minutes ago," the co-pilot replied. "The storm breaks up over France, the Mediterranean is clear, and it stays that way into Riyadh."
"Clearances and papers in order?" the pilot asked.
"We're good to go," the co-pilot said.
"I have the distance at 3,100 miles, the pilot said.
"Just over 5.5 hours flight time," the co-pilot offered.
"Now, if we just had our cargo."
"If the owner tells you to wait," the co-pilot said, "you wait."
The pilot nodded.
"What's on the telly tonight?"
"The replay of the Hyde Park concert with Elton John," the co-pilot said. "The opening acts are starting soon."
The pilot rose and walked over to the kitchen area.
"I'll microwave us some popcorn."
"Extra butter on mine," the co-pilot said.
Michaels lined up over the river and landed. After steering over to the shore, the men secured the plane with ropes to some nearby trees, then offloaded the cargo and stood on the shore. MI5 had all their assets tied up in London, so there was no one to meet them.
"Anyone know how to hotwire a car?" Halpert asked.
"I do," Rise said.
"Cliff," Halpert said, "go with Tom and find something big enough to transport us and the gear."
"Will do,"
Hornsby said, climbing the bank with Rise and walking toward town. Halpert studied the map as he waited. He'd had Michaels fly over Maidenhead Mills on the way here.
Now all he had to do was find the route on the map.
Once he had that done, he turned to Michaels, who was still on the plane.
"Can you spare a cup of that coffee?" he asked.
Michaels slipped inside the cockpit and poured a cup, then handed it to Halpert on shore.
"What's the plan?" she asked.
"First, we watch," Halpert said. "Then we pounce." At that moment, Tom Rise pulled alongside the bank in an old British Ford flatbed truck. Several chicken coops were on the bed near the cab, along with some rusty tools and a length of chain.
"Sorry about the ride," Rise said, climbing out, "but beggars can't be choosers."
"Let's load it up," Halpert said, handing Rise the marked map.
"I'll be monitoring the radio," Michael said as the men transported the cargo to the flatbed. "Good luck."
Halpert smiled, but didn't say a word. Once everyone was aboard, he pounded on the bed.
"Let's roll."
With a swirl of snow, the truck lurched away from the bank in the direction of the mill.